Underworld, Disc 16.
At Army Intelligence School, he did double shifts of classwork, surrounded every edgy minute by combat analysts, language experts, counterintelligence guys snooping out drug use, by agent trainees on simulated missions, a spook for every body function. They sent him to Vietnam, to Phu Bai. And the first thing he saw when he entered the compound was a flourish of spray paint graffiti on the wall of a supply shed. Om Mani Padme Hum. Matt knew this was some kind of mantra, a thing hippies chanted in Central Park. But could it also be the motto of the 131st Aviation Company? From this point on, he had trouble with the input. He worked in a Quonset hut, cranking rolls of film across a light box. This was the take from Aerial Recon, an endless series of images sucked up by the belly cameras of surveillance planes. It was all about lost information, how to recover the minutest unit of data and identify it as a truck driven by a man smoking a French cigarette going down the Ho Chi Minh Trail. He tossed a frisbee to a gook dog and watched the animal leap and twist. There were rumors about a secret war. Bombs in unnumbered tons dropped from B-52s. Laos, chaos, Cambodia. Except the tons were not unnumbered, but conscientiously counted, because this is how we earn our stripes, by quantifying the product. Matt was a Spec 5, the same pay grade as a sergeant, but less command authority. That was okay with him. The rocket attacks were not okay, or the mortar rounds that came arcing down out of the rain. The rains came, and the sirens sounded, and he went to the nearest entrenchment, a shelter put together with sandbags and construction debris with an open sewer running through. The heat and heroin came, and there was the odd body found face down in the muddy company street, a casualty of smack. Someone hung a photo of Nixon in the Quonset hut, two men flanking him, familiar somehow but unrecallable, and there were rumors about a substance stored in black drums near the perimeter of the compound. In the movie version, you'd freeze the frame with the dog in mid-leap, about to snare the frisbee. A park on a summer's day somewhere in America. That would be the irony of the shot, with a solo guitar producing the bitter screech of feedback. This is what happens when part of a system's output is returned to the input. Yes, someone tacked up a magazine page, and Matt couldn't quite identify the two men who flanked the president. But they weren't politicians or corporation heads. A curly-haired man, handsome and smiling, and a sad-eyed guy with a honker nose and the leaden aspect of an immigrant in a borrowed suit. He cranked the film across the light box. When he found a dot on the film, he tried to make a determination. It was a truck, or a truck stop, or a tunnel entrance, or a gun emplacement, or a family grilling burgers at a picnic. It was hot and monotonous, and planes came and went all the time. Gunships, transports, medium bombers, stratotankers, fighter jets, executive jets, a little pink piper carrying an instructor and a student, and finally converted cargo planes spraying the jungle with a herbicide stored in black drums that had identifying orange stripes. There were rumors about whole other wars just to the east. Or was it west? The drums resembled cans of frozen Minute Maid, enlarged by a crazed strain of DNA. And the substance in the drums contained, so the rumor went, a cancer-causing agent. He heard the rumors and the mortars and felt the monsoon heat and heard the universal slogan of the war, "Stay stoned, man." He'd wanted to come to Vietnam. He'd been back and forth in his mind about the war, but thought this was a thing he had to do, a form of self-reckoning. Stay straight, be brave, answer when your country calls. But there was also something else, the older, blood-born force known as family. He could not evade the sense of responsibility. It was there to be confronted. He didn't want to slip away, sneak through, get off cheap, dodge, desert, resist, chicken out, turn tail, flee to Canada, Sweden, or San Francisco, as his old man had done. When he found a dot on the film, he translated it into letters, numbers, coordinates, grids, and entire systems of knowledge. Om Mani Padme Hum. In fact, the dog didn't leap at all, but only watched the frisbee sail past, more or less disdainfully. A dot was a visual mantra, an object that had no properties except location, the jewel in the heart of the lotus. He was in his sleeping bag, but wasn't asleep. He wanted company and woke up Janet. He stuck his arm out of the bag and reached over and shook her awake. I want the same things you want.
All right, Matthew.
I want us to be surrounded by familiar things. I'm excited about it. I want to start right away.
You ought to wait. Stay where you are. Work for another year at this job. See what happens, she said.
I want to think up nicknames for our children. Do you know what I mean? I want us to be surrounded. I want photographs, silverware, things we'll pass on someday. I want to talk about what we're having for dinner. You like baked clams? We've barely ever talked about food, you and I.
Stay where you are, she told him. Don't do anything in a hurry.
I'm excited about this. I wish it wasn't going to take so long to get out of here. I'd like to start driving basically right now.
Go to sleep, she told him.
There's so many things to talk about. She was asleep inside a minute. Matt lay there helpless against his racing mind. He understood finally that he wouldn't be able to sleep, and he decided to watch the sun come up over the desert. He put on his pants and a sweater and went out behind the bunker about 50 yards, where he switched off the flashlight. Then he sat in the dirt and waited. He remembered how he'd felt sitting in a chair at the bombhead party, locked in a gravitational field, his head buzzing with suspicion. He thought of a photograph of Nixon and wondered if the state had taken on the paranoia of the individual, or was it the other way around? He remembered how he felt cranking film across the light box and wondered where the dots connected. Because everything connects in the end, or only seems to. Or seems to only because it does. At the light box, he was a parody of the traditional figure in the basement room. The lone inventor stooped over his work table, piecing together the pins, springs, and wires of some eccentric contraption. The light bulb idea that would change the world. And the voice with the Hungarian accent, Eric Deming speaking into his face in the crowded room. The dots on the film might have been trucks going down the supply route, or new model cars coming off the line, or condoms that looked like fingers on a latex glove. And someone in the Quonset hut had to tell him who they were. Nixon, flanked by a couple of ball players. Old-time guys. A winner-loser sort of thing. Joined at the hip for life. He sat in the dust with his eyes closed and smelled the wet resin of a creosote bush and began to sense light about to break somewhere. People hide in their basement rooms. They take to the bunkers and tunnels as weapons roll identically off the line and begin to light up the sky. And how can you tell the difference between orange juice and Agent Orange if the same massive system connects them at levels outside your comprehension? And how can you tell if this is true when you're already systemed under, prepared to half believe everything because this is the only intelligent response? People hide in dark, dank places where mushrooms grow, sprouting quickly. The dots he marked with his grease pencil became computer bits in Da Nang, Sunday brunch in Saigon, and mission briefings in Thailand, he guessed, or Guam. When you alter a single minor component, the system adapts at once. Somebody had to give him the names. The president flanked by Thompson and Branca, Bobby and Ralph, the binary hero goat, inseparable to the end. A mushroom with a fleshy cap that might be poisonous or magical. In Siberia somewhere, the shamans ate the cap and were born again. What did they see in their trance state? Was it a cloud shaped like a mushroom? He was in the pocket, even then, cranking film all night long, waiting for the mortar rounds to come raining down. They made a crunch like a kid eating cereal on TV. And how can you tell the difference between syringes and missiles if you've become so pliant, ready to half-believe everything and to fix conviction in nothing? And how can you know if the image existed before the bomb was invented? There may have been an underworld of images known only to tribal priests, mediums between visible reality and the spirit world, and they popped magic mushrooms and saw a fiery cloud that predated the image on the U.S. Army training film. "Watched from a safe distance," says the narrator, "this explosion is one of the most beautiful sights ever seen by man." He was in the pocket, even then, in a way, but didn't think along the system's track to the culmination of his tedious little labors. The 1,000-pound bombs clustering out of the bays of B-52s like finned pellets of excrement, cratering the jungle trail. But they were the enemy, so what the hell? And they're the enemy still. Or someone is. And he opened his eyes, and saw the sky go an odd sort of mad granny gray. Ideas used to come from below. Now they're everywhere above you, connecting things and grids universally. The binary black-white, yes-no, 0-1, hero-goat. And the two men flanking the president in the photo tacked up on the Quonset wall, the tallish, handsome fellow and the bushy-browed immigrant, could just as easily be Oppenheimer and Teller, their bodies greased with suntan oil as they quote Hindu scriptures to each other. Om does not rhyme with bomb. It only looks that way. Death and magic, that's the mushroom. Or death and immortal life. Psilocybin is a compound obtained from a Mexican mushroom that can turn your soul into fissionable material, according to scholars of the phenomenon. They are everywhere at the same time, endlessly connected. And you half believe the most implausible things because you'd be stupid not to. All technology refers to the bomb. He sat in the dust with his eyes opened and realized the sun was rising behind him and wondered what this meant. It meant he'd been facing in the wrong direction all along. Matt drove the Jeep. Janet drowsed next to him. Drowsed a while and got bounced awake and nodded off again. He felt good, clear-minded. He drove and thought. He saw everything. He identified plants without the book. The sun was still very low, and the track would take them right into it for a time before veering gradually north. He saw the rubble turn to sand. He saw the silty limestone bottoms of dried-out creeks that paralleled the track. He heard the wing-whir of mourning doves breaking out of the bush. He saw a dust devil on a level stretch of desert doing slow-motion spirals. There was an odd, charged pause. Then the roar descended on them, so close it stopped his blood. and Janet grabbed an arm. No, first she fell against him, knocked sideways by the force of the noise, a flat, cracking boom, and then she snatched his arm and missed and grabbed again. He sat there with his head hammered into his shoulders. The jeep left the track, but he freed his arm from Janet's clutch and steered it back. He realized his other arm was raised just over his head, curled above him in defense. The noise broke over them and washed past, nearly taking them with it. And Janet was looking at him. Her mouth made a small, smooth, lonesome oval. Matt was intently absorbing the news. He was sorting through. He was looking toward the mountains, ready to be happy. Then he saw the twin glint just before they disappeared, a pair of F-4 Phantoms in silver skin reaching the top of their arc before leveling off. Just thought they'd skim the desert on a quiet morning. He was happy, hearing the echo carom off the ranges now, a remnant thunder that cross-called from the little Ajo Mountains to the Growler Mountains to the Granites and the Mohawks and out into the towns and truck stops. Yes, he loved the way power rises out of self-caressing secrecy to become a roar in the sky. He imagined the sound waves passing over the land and lapping forward in time, over weeks and months, cross-country, eventually becoming the gentlest sort of rockabye rhyme in a small, safe room where a mother nurses a baby and a man stands with his arm over his head, a research fellow. Not in fear of shattered plaster and flying glass, but only to draw down the shade. The sky is going dark, and a tangy savor drifts from the kitchen. And there is music in the house. But it was the steroid jolt he experienced now. The goose flesh, the prickling thrill that traveled over his body as they sat trembling in the little jeep. They weren't yet ready to talk to each other. They needed a moment to collect themselves, speechless in the wake of a power and thrust snatched from nature's own greatness. Or how men bend heaven to their methods. Chapter 5. First there was an empty room. Then someone appeared and began to put things on a table, to move the magazines and picture books, and put out bowls and crocks, and cut flowers, and then to reinstate some of the picture books, but only the ones that claimed a status of a certain sumptuous kind. Then a few people arrived, and there was sporadic conversation, a little awkward at times, because not everyone knew everyone. Then the room slowly filled, and the talk came more easily, and the faces shed some layers. Clara spoke with someone in a corner, half aware that the spirit of being friendly and funny and well-met was overtaking the place. And isn't it one of those things you never consider but might find amazing if you did, how the details of contact, the eye movement and hand waves, the smiles of recognition, the catch-up lives that propel the early dialogue, how this becomes an energy that moves among the guests like a circulating angel, inspiring stories, rumors, flirtations, and misconstrued remarks, basically the makings of human history, even though people don't drink the way they used to. So you can't say it's the gin that makes them happy and natural. It's mainly the encouragement of others. It was the rooftop summer, the summer of sheet lightning, and she watched thunderheads go white in the gunned flash. Threat of rain, said the weather, but it rarely rained. She waited for Miles to show up with her cigarettes, and thought that being alive had never seemed such luck, although she was getting nervous about her work because it just wasn't coming. In a corner of the room she talked to a man who complained about people keeping large dogs in small apartments, and after guests began to leave, she took the elevator to the roof, and a young woman said, "I semi-lost my mind." "I semi-lost my mind." And there was a man, a painter Clara knew, with a great-looking necktie. and she thought that keeping dogs in small apartments was one of those subjects nobody talks about, and then everybody does. Abruptly. It comes flowing out of doors and windows. Should you or shouldn't you? Only to stop one day with a ruthless sort of suddenness, leaving the dogs undiscussed. Rare Siberian breeds and studio walk-ups. She watched the runner on the track on the top of an office tower, a woman in day-glow sweats at sundown, with smokestacks in the distance. Three or four people stood at the ledge with drinks, watching with matched pleasure, and the jogger went around the track, alone, 30 stories up, and it was a beautiful thing to see. The woman's lightsome stride, and the great faded day that shows burningly in the glass slabs, and then the power company's smokestacks down near the river, blowing gorgeous poisons. She walked through Times Square with Miles, and he made her stop to admire a pimp-mobile parked in a tow-away zone outside a topless pinball parlor. The car was painted rose and mauve, and the side windows were protected by iron grillwork. Guy's got an urban sense of humor. Tourists took pictures, posing each other in front of the car, taking turns, snapping and posing. And there were Krishna skinheads with handbells, young and pale in ochre robes and high-top sneakers, jumping devoutly up and down. A.C. Green had a grandmother act she did, mostly vocal, in which she referred to Clara as child, reprimandingly. "Oh, child, please, don't be such a fool." They were in a Soho bar. "It's impossible," Clara said. "A woman doesn't even think of marrying someone like Miles."
"Who you wouldn't want to marry whether you thought about it or not."
"Give him a little credit."
"That's what I give him," A.C. said.
"No, Miles is great. But you'd have to be crazy to try something permanent, or even halfway binding. Can't be done, either from your viewpoint or his."
"Just the word cohabitation."
"That's right," and Clara laughed, "the word alone. He's a little evasive, would be my general, you know." "He's a little unready," Clara said. And the more she talked about his irresponsibility, the more affection she felt for the man. "There is always a plot potential, you see," and she laughed again. "He sees things closing in and becomes defensive when withdrawn. But it's not an issue. There are no issues between him and me. We get along great." Things flew out of her hand. A coffee mug flew right out of her hand and over the kitchen counter. She couldn't find the veal cutlets she'd just bought. Then she looked around for the extra key to the downstairs door. The key could only be in one of two places. There were no other possibilities, worldwide. But it wasn't here, and it wasn't there. And she stood at one end of the loft, staring through the tall windows opposite, and she wondered if the fire escapes, if those dark lines intersecting in depth over the back alleys could tell her something about her work.
"You'd be whistling Dixie, child," said A.C. in the bar.
For a while she used house paint, radiator paint. She liked rough surfaces, flaked paint on metal. She liked puttied window frames, all the gesso textures, the gluey chalks and linseeds that get mixed and smeared, that get smeared onto a weathered length of wood. And it took her years to understand how this was connected to her life, to the working-class grain, the pocked sidewalks, beautiful blue slate, in fact, cracked and granuled at the corners, and the tar roofs, and the fire escapes, of course, painted green and then black, and how the flow-off of drips and trickles became elements of memory, and the aluminum paint on the whistling radiators, and the paint her father carried home to recoat the kitchen chairs, the chair upended on a newspaper page, and the spidery plash of white paint on the inked page, and the spattered page on the old linoleum. At Esther and Jack's, she held a glass of wine and listened to Jack talk in his friendly, sandpaper voice. She liked his voice, and she liked his jokes. Old, ruddy, gray-haired Jack, somehow still alive, waving his cigarette and ever on the verge of forgetting your name. Jack was greatly given to robust jokes that Esther hated, and Clara kind of liked. The kind of joke you're supposed to like in spite of yourself. Outdated stories with stupid stereotypes and a range of dialects, but sly in the manner in which they welcome the listener's complicity. Jack told jokes in which nothing ever changes. At some point she realized she was putting down paint, mainly to take it off. Scrape it with a kitchen tool. She liked the veiny residue. And her radius of endeavor, her smallish ambition, what she saw as a clustering in her work, a familial thing, determinedly modest. She was only now beginning to wonder if she wanted to ensure herself a life unlaureled, like her father's. Albert used to tell her in his slightly didactic way that the Italians of his experience, his Harlem and Bronx upbringing, his Calabrian heritage, tended to be wary of certain kinds of accomplishment. As immigrants, people who needed protection against the cold hand of the culture, who needed sons and daughters and sisters and others, because who else could they trust with their broken English, their 10,000 uprooted tales? And he came home one day, the 13-year-old son, and saw his parents huddled on the sofa in one of those dolorous southern states of theirs, his mother's eyes dark-pocketed, drained by betrayal, and his father helpless and bent, a 40-year-old man who could double his age in an eye-blink through membership in some cooperative of sorrow. And they were looking at Albert's report card, just mailed from school. And he thought he'd failed everything, flunked out, been expelled, D's at best and funereal F's. But it was just the reverse, wasn't it? A row of A's, with little gold stars stuck to the margins of the card. And young Bronzini eventually understood the nature of their distress, that they didn't want to lose him. The shopkeeper and the shopkeeper's wife, to the large, bright world that began at some floating point only blocks away. Clara didn't see herself sharing this state of mind, even remotely, until now, sitting alone in the loft, knowing how guarded she was about certain accomplishments. Not other people's, but her own. How distrustful and slightly shamed. She needed to be loyal to the past, even if this meant, most of all if this meant, incorporating her father's disappointments, merging herself with the many little failures he amassed like faded keepsakes. She thought of his viewmaster reels of the Grand Canyon and the Great West, the unreachable spaces he clicked into place on his stereoscope. And she recalled so clearly the image of the Hopi scout posed on the edge of some rimrock, and whatever it was out there in the 3D distance, the painted desert or Zion Park, and how her own smallness, her unnoticeability, was precisely the destiny she'd assigned herself. AC was drinking tequila, and Clara took her usual humdrum ration of white wine, because she liked white in the afternoon, on the days when she had a glass before 6 or so, and red with dinner. And a dead afternoon in a dark bar was not the worst of fates.
"What are you doing that I should know about, work-wise?"
AC said. "I'm going to Sagaponack to hide out."
"Hide out? You don't hide out there. You hide out here."
"Depends on what you're hiding from."
"Start working. Just start working. What are you sitting here for?"
AC said.
"You ain't making history looking at me."
It was so humid you had to put your shoulder to the door or it would not close. She heard those shots on a terrace somewhere, and then she saw the striped awning, Cinzano, and knew the sound was only canvas snapping in the wind. Clara talked about her early days painting, trying to paint, and how it was small-scale hell in a number of ways, but was beginning now to seem late bohemian and sort of pastel-edged until she made herself remember more rigorously.
"Men treated us male painters, let's face it, the big names, as if we were dumb little would-be artists. Students forever, you know, in knee socks. At best, she said. And speaking of work... What? I gave you some public praise the other day. I was talking to a woman doing a piece on younger artists. I told her who to watch. And in return... And that's not the first time. And I want you to know it means a lot. Shut up. In return, Clara said, you're required to give me a verbal preview. Because if I'm going to sit here and be envious of someone who's working, at least you can tell me what you're doing. AC's mouth did its sneery lift and curl. She looked at Clara and finished her drink and issued a kind of scorched sigh. Okay. You remember the Marilyn Monroe calendar you saw in my studio? Sure. And you know how it is when you're starting on a project, how you sometimes have to start with a series of misunderstandings? I always start that way. I thought and worked and sketched and did small oils and large charcoals, and finally I realized it's not Marilyn I want. It's fake Marilyn. I want a packaged look. I didn't want Monroe. I wanted Mansfield. All bloated lips and total boobs. I mean, it was so obvious, and it took me fucking forever. Have I ever seen a Jane Mansfield movie? Nobody has. Doesn't matter. She was uncontainable in a movie, AC said. And there are all the other Marilyns. On the one hand, you can never have too many Marilyns. On the other hand, the minute Marilyn died, all the other sexpots died with her. They were, like, philosophically banned from existing. Jane outlived Marilyn by only 5 years, and for about 4.5 of those years she was bummed out, washed up, beat up by husband number whatever he was, and there was nothing left but exploitation movies and heavy drinking. You're crossing over. White women, Clara said. Jane was a white whale. I had to shake off a lot of higher-minded shit before I got to where I am with this work. And I'm doing some things with color I want your opinion of. Anytime. Because you're the one I trust. Paying phony compliments is hard work, Clara said. That's why I don't do it. It was the summer of Nixon waving on TV, clutching Ike's wrist in the 50s clips, or the hand jerk over the head, sudden and neurologically odd, or the final wave from the helicopter on the lawn, arms shooting out, fingers shaping a sad pair of V's. Or the clips of the late 60s that showed his arms wantonly flung in the winged gesture of victory, of resentful, writhing triumph. Here I am, you bastard, still alive and kicking. Miles talked her into going to Bloomingdale's to help him buy a gift for his mother, because she'd be thrilled and slightly shamed, his mother would, wrapped in happy chagrin outside Toledo to own a thing from Bloomingdale's. They went through a vast area of reflecting surfaces and little knobby bottles and the cling of 100 teeming essences, and Clara finally found something, a batik blouse and vaguely Persian slippers. And they were headed out through the menswear area, touches of autumn decor and many tables and displays, racks of field coats and fleece liners, and Miles said, "Wait." "What is it?" she wondered, and he put a hand to her arm. "Wait, look, do not speak." Then she saw what he meant. 8 or 9 boys, black kids, moving among the suits and knit sweaters, maybe a dozen now, adolescents mostly, but some no older than 10. Then she saw a guard coming from the perimeter, summoned by walkie-talkie, and the younger kids were trying to go unnoticed among the mirrored surfaces, somewhat comically, their eyeballs doing surreptitious scans. And they must have felt the pressure by now, the full weight of observation. One of them grabbed a jacket, half-hurried, and one of them said something, and they all moved now, converging on one display. They grabbed and ran, jackets flying off hangers and hangers bouncing on the floor. And they grabbed what they could, 2, 3 jackets, some of them, or only one, or 2 kids snatching the same jacket, and ran for different exits. There were 2 guards coming fast, and another semi-crouched by the main door. The customers stood motionless and alert, fixed in neutral zones. And one kid was pinned by a guard, and Clara had a sense of 6 others scatter-running through the store, weaving and shying off, all the jacket arms flapping.
and Miles said, "Leather," in a voice that rang with broadest joy. He said, "They take the subway down to 59th Street and come up the stairs right into the store, and they flood one area and grab what they can, and then they're out of here, man, in a dozen directions." He said, "Security gets a hold of two, maybe three kids at most." He said, "Notice they didn't take the big insulated parkas. They didn't take the warm stuff or the hooded stuff or the down vests. Only leather. They took the leather." And his voice was musical with admiration. AC leaned over her empty glass. "How old was he?" "I don't know. 17, 18. I don't think I wanted to know." 17's a man. "I was teaching kids to draw part-time, and I had a baby, 2 or 3 years old, and this was awesome enough, and my husband's mother, who was bedridden, although maybe she died by then, and my husband, of course, as well. And this juvenile delinquent in his, what, did they wear peg pants? He came on to you?" "I don't know who came on to whom. Only thing I know, we're in the spare room next to where my mother-in-law just died." AC's eyes went humorously wide, and she let her mouth hang open. "Maybe you're right. 17's a man," Clara said. "Because one thing this was not. This was not a case of sexual initiation. It wasn't at all tender. And he didn't need instruction, especially. And you're also right about juvenile delinquent. Except the term doesn't do justice to the thing he eventually did." She looked down the cornice line of Park Avenue to the New York Central building, with its traffic arches and great clock and floodlit summit, and she wasn't sleeping well lately. And someone stood next to her looking at the same thing she was looking at, and she went inside to watch Nixon wave. Esther Winship's apartment was lavishly understated. Beiges, off-whites, great stayed sofas that did not give when you sat, and expanses of dunnish rug, deep-piled, and almost no pictures. And the few pictures Esther elected to hang were self-effacing to the point of who cares. And the place had so much attitude, all tension and edge, that Jack seemed largely lost here. Esther said, "I haven't given up, you know. I've sent agents into the field."
"For what?"
"Moon Man. I thought we'd forgotten all that. Besides, didn't somebody do a graffiti show? It didn't include him. I think it's just as well you don't find him." "Why is that, sweetie?" "You'll sign him and dump me." Esther liked that. She had a laugh that was 2,000 years old, salty and hoarse. And Clara found it strange to feel the way she did about graffiti writers. It should have been Esther who decried the marked-up trains, defaced, ugly, like mobile dumpsters. Esther in her flawless suits and face powders and lightly clanging jewelry. Esther, she thought, and not for the first time, her dealer and friend and enemy. "That is the utterest nonsense, of course."
"Just tell me when we're going," Clara said.
"Out to my place?
So I can stop the mail."
"You're invited, you know. We're all going. It's official. Friday week."
"I love stopping the mail," Clara said.
And it should have been her who defended the graffitists, daredevil kids who put color and spunk into the seismic blur of a rush hour Monday. "Chance of rain," said the weather. But it didn't rain. The garbage was down there in identical black plastic bags, leaching out, beginning to burn its way out of the bags. And she looked and did not look for rats, passing the mound on her way to the Y. She swam nearly every day at the Y, and then not so often, and then only once a week, because the point of swimming was to take the edge off work, return her to the offsetting rhythms. The agreeable, mild monotony of what is left of you after a long pull of work and isolation. It was the summer of damson plums, juicy and bluish, and she loved the water towers that hung at dusk, raised on pillars and stilts, like oddments of the carpentered city, the least likely things to survive, dowels and staves, the old streaked wood hooped in its delicate bulk. In a little roof garden with a cheapo copy of a marble from the Acropolis, a male figure minus arms and head and most of one leg, and with a ravaged cock and bird-blown shit on his left peck. And why was he so sexy, Clara thought. It was here that she saw the man for the third time in about 7 weeks, Carlos Strasser, the amateur art collector, and whatever else he was, in his splendid Italian shoes, with a farmhouse, she recalled, near Arles. It turned out the host had been meaning to invite the two of them to dinner for the longest time. And it turned out Carlo was in solid-state electronics, traveled to Hong Kong and Taiwan on business, and had once flown to Mexico City to see a soccer game.
"Actually, I was supposed to be in Dusseldorf today." He pronounced it comically. "But I thought, you know, life is short, and I get on too many planes lately. And besides..."
"Besides, you can pick up the phone."
"I can pick up the phone, absolutely. Someone is there at the other end."
All around them on brownstone roofs were skylights and tall vents with spiral caps, and new metal fencing that extended past the roof edge to discourage cat burglars. And late at night she woke up in the loft and thought she was somewhere else. Not somewhere else, but in a place that wasn't hers, because even after years here, she couldn't wake up without feeling she was in alien space, in dream space still. The height and breadth of the area, the pillars and tall windows, were out of some early dream, not quite nightmarish, of a child located at the edge of a room, or a child dreaming the room, but not in it herself, a room surreally open at one end, where the child stands, or the dream begins. A room where things, where objects are called chairs and curtains and beds, but are also completely different, unsupported by the usual guarantees. And she shifted in the bed and woke up Miles. They went to the Fulton Fish Market, and Miles took photographs. It was 4 in the morning, of a row of enormous swordfish chucked down on the pavement. What an epic of misplacement, these great sea creatures beached on a New York street. And then they found an all-night diner and had bacon and eggs and coffee. Miles wanted to talk about A.C. Green. "This stuff she's doing, you know what she's doing, don't you? A group of paintings on the Black Panthers. More crap being dumped on black males." She let him talk. "You overrate her about 200%. Her stuff is all show. It's a cut above total shit. You need to look again. It's all surface. She's catering. She's pandering to white ideas about scary blacks." Clara realized that in her praise of AC's work, she'd been waiting all along for someone to disagree. Now here it was. The moment sat in her stomach in a lump with the egg yolk and rye toast. "You know how it works. She got what she wanted from you. Approval, publicity, whatever. Now she's greasing other wheels." Clara sat there in an odd kind of thoughtful silence. She wanted him to keep talking. Say it all, whether it's true or not. She felt completely ungenerous, but thought he might have a point about AC's work. He had useful intuitions about art. It was one of the things between them, of course, and how he'd stand before one of Clara's pieces and let her know with a few well-placed words and with his general surrender to the object that he saw what she was doing. "She loves the slippers," he said. "She loves the slippers. What are we talking about?" "Oh, your mother. She loves the slippers." "She loves the slippers. Good. I'm happy." Or possibly the case could be stated thus. He was totally wrong about AC's work, but maybe she wanted him to be right. In Sagaponack, she dropped her bag in the guest room and went to visit painters all over the local map. They painted in sheds, whitewashed studios, and renovated potato barns. And she went mostly alone, borrowing Esther's car because Esther was on the phone trying to deal with landlords and lawyers. At dinner, Jack got dizzy and lay on the sofa, and the evening more or less went on around him. She stood on the sand and watched the waves barrel up and come snugging beachward. She called Miles, who was leaving the next day for Normal, Illinois. She met a sculptor with a face full of burst capillaries. English. His wife was dying, and she had a long talk with him, a completely intense conversation about the way in which their work exposed them, layer by layer, as inadequate. And they took solace one from the other, seeing how such things can be shared, no matter how seemingly unique. And embraced when she left. Esther said, "You're looking sexy lately, you know that?"
"Says who?"
"Old Jack." Clara typically grew tired of old Jack, and then took his side, sympathizing, saying Jack has a point, and finding him funny, and then finding him tiresome again, even pathetic at times. But he loved Esther in the sweetest way, spoke about it openly, and didn't care who heard, and told waiters and doormen how good she was in bed. And Esther knew it wasn't possible to stop him, and probably didn't want to. They both needed the drama of public avowals, because how else could their vividness survive? Things flew out of her hand. A glass flew out of her hand when she was standing on someone's deck. Alone in Esther's car, she talked about left turn and right turn, reciting directions aloud, telling herself to stop on red. On the phone, Miles said, "People don't think it's totally, you know, bizarre that a woman can get sick every time Henry Kissinger gets sick 1,000 miles away. We, the ungreat, have to get our diseases any way we can." A wind started blowing and wouldn't stop, and it carried a faint taste of summer's end, and Esther said, "It's like the Tramontana." And Clara thought oddly of Albert, or not so oddly. He loved the Italian words for different kinds of winds blowing off the Alps and up from the African littoral. And she didn't really like the English sculptor's work, if we're going to be honest about it, whatever their affinity of ominous doubt. "No, seriously, you look great," Esther said. The night's so breezy and clean. Shadows, whispers, a man's chin line, his hair, how he holds a wine glass. Esther said, "Jack's a baby, of course. That's why he stayed on the sofa when he was feeling out of sorts the other night. He wanted to be with people. He's the biggest baby ever. But if he dies on me, I'll go to pieces in a tenth of a second." She loved them both, and told them when she left, and meant it, the way you always mean it after 4 blowy days and nights, and good food and talk, and the potato fields running clear to the dunes under high, swift skies. Such luck to be alive, she thought, and took the train back, humanly invisible in her roomy seat, where she smoked a cigarette and looked forward to being home. Home alone, surrounded by all the things and textures that make you familiar, once again, to yourself. Her father used to say the best part of a trip is coming home. But when did they ever go away? Only rarely and briefly. A rented bungalow on a lake with another family, because God forbid we shouldn't feel crowded, her mother said. And let's hurry back before someone steals the note we left for the milkman. When Clara's mother found a business card in his jacket, she was taking his suit to the cleaner and found a business card with his name but no company. And the name was spelled S-A-X. And of course she asked him about it. He told her it was for trips he might take. He wanted to have a card to give to someone he might meet on a train. Her mother said, "That's not what I'm asking. Never mind such a trip as strictly, I don't want to say what." "So then what are you asking?" "I'm asking the spelling," her mother said. "Sachs is not a hard name." He said, "It's not a question of hard or easy." Her mother said, "What is S-A-X? This is what? You're changing careers, this means? We have a jazz musician in the house?" He said, "It's a small thing. Never mind." Her mother said, "It's not so small." He said, "The names are pronounced the same. It's a small thing. I only change the spelling so it's easy for someone to pronounce on a train who's accustomed to easy names, which most names in business, they're easy, if you'll notice." "Sachs is an easy name."
Her mother said, "This is not a hard name, unless the train you're talking about is full of people who are a little funny, let's say, in the head." Her mother's maiden name was Soloveitchik. He said, "It's not the name is easy or hard, it's what the letters say. That whole business of the CH." Her mother said, "What whole business?" And her father made a sound that Clara would not forget. She thought about it many times in the years since he made the sound. He made a sound, a harsh guttural, produced at the back of the mouth, rattling and metallic, filled with rancor. And at first she thought he had the card printed because he didn't want people to make the mistake of thinking he was German. And then she thought he had the card printed because he didn't want people to know he was a Jew. People on trains. Businessmen with their own cards, and shaving kits, and private compartments on the most important trains out of Grand Central Station. And how curious, what a distance he sought to travel from the grating sound of that CH with its breadth of reference, its guttural history and culture, those heavy hallway smells and accents, from this to the unknown X, mark of Mr. Anonymous. And the change provoked Clara's loyalty precisely because it made no practical sense, because it exposed the mind spirals of a certain kind of torment. Her father was a billing clerk in a department store. Then he was an insurance agent, working on commission in the drearier reaches of the Bronx. They gave him the Negro neighborhoods and Chinese laundries and the immigrants from everywhere, just off the boat. He painted signs for a while, company names on frosted glass doors, applying gold leaf with a sable brush, a thing he did well, but hated.
"It's only a business card," he said. "I didn't go to a judge and get my name changed. On my tombstone you can carve the regular spelling to your heart's content."
Her mother said, "How come I never knew you played an instrument?" And when Clara's divorce from Albert became final, she changed her name from Bronzini back to Sachs, but made a point of spelling it with an X. If only publicly, in her emerging identity as an artist, it was how she signed her work. "Yes, well, maybe it's true. 17's a man," Clara said. "And I've asked myself, was the thing more important than I was willing to admit? In other words, did it show you a way out? Did it point a way out? Which you didn't want to think about at the time." AC didn't want another drink, and Clara still had half a glass of wine. And they talked away the afternoon, one of those dead summer days in a dark and empty bar. And he didn't seem to make too much of it himself. He was, I thought, remarkably unconfused and even-keeled, was my impression. My second husband sailed a yacht, but was not so even-keeled, and I don't know why I'm bringing that up. She laughed and sipped her wine. He drank Tanqueray martinis, Jason did. He took a bottle of Tanqueray every time we went to Maine, or a couple of bottles, I guess. We were allowed to forget the vermouth, but not the gin. But we didn't forget the vermouth, either. And I loved going up there. But I used to wonder sometimes in the most detached sort of way. How it happened. How did it happen that I'd marry a man who says what he says and thinks what this man thinks? And drinks martinis, AC said. They talked about other things. They talked about work. See, Marilyn hated being Marilyn, but Jane loved it, AC said. She was born to be Marilyn. She lived in a pink palace that had a sizable zoo. And the way these things happen, the discount sex queen becomes famous and famous and famous, and finally she's the most photographed woman in the world. And she died how? AC lowered her head to her chest, doubling up her chin and doing a southern sheriff's voice. Horrific car crash, like Jimmy Dean. Are you painting the wreck? No, I want a Jane that's a living, threatening presence. This is one greasy, peroxide blonde. Constant secretions from every quarter. This is a woman with a heavy flow. Atomic Jane. Anytime you're ready to show it, Clara said.
and the sun had cleared a building nearby and was beating on the street.
You worry too much, AC said. You worry about the work you're not doing because you feel deeply obliged to justify. I think you're always justifying in your mind. And you also worry about the work you've done, because considering what you gave up and took away, considering the damage you caused, if we tell it like it is, child, you need to convince yourself your work is good enough to justify this.
They paid the bill. AC put her hands on the older woman's shoulders and pressed tight, sort of macho motherly, and the bartender brought their change. In Sagaponic, Esther wore safari outfits and talked on the phone. She said to Clara at breakfast, "Who cuts your hair? Did they arrest the mass murderer who cuts your hair?" At someone's house, Clara talked with a woman it turned out she used to know, a painter from the early days, the industrial spaces on the East River, near the ferry terminal, where Clara lived after her divorce, with a makeshift shower and no stove, $50 a month. And met painters and sculptors, people who worked with found material. And the street was paved with old stone blocks, once used as ballast, perhaps. And they used to gather on the roof sometimes, three or four painters, and a wife or husband, and a couple of kids, and a dog someone was keeping for someone else. And the two women remembered how Clara never sat on the sloped part of the roof, on the tar paper surface that sloped up to the edge, because she was afraid of edges. And there was a sense of sea passage and new work. And off to the north, situated beyond the rooftop, between the rooftop and the great bridge, was the polyhedral mass of towered downtown. The wind blew day and night. And Jack said, "I'm reasonably sure that's what's-his-name over there, who used to be married to the paper bag woman. It was a great scandal. She was the paper bag heiress, and I sat next to her at dinner. This was, God help me, 25 years ago. Esther knows who I'm talking about. It was a major scandal. Esther, help me out here." The thing about Jack is that he sounded drunk when he wasn't, and then made beautiful, courtly sense absolutely blotto. They were in a small basement place in Chinatown, eating broad noodles that were very tasty. Chow Fun or Chow Fan, the menu was spattered. A place with formica tables and spattered menus and no liquor license. And Miles with a mint toothpick in his mouth. "I got a movie to show you that you're going to hate me for this movie." "We can't be talking about Normal," she said. "We shot about 11 hours in Normal. She was inexhaustible, this woman, because she was born that way. She comes across like a law of physics. But I still don't know what we've got. Could be crap." "And in the meantime?" "You're going to hate this other thing. But there's no question of not seeing it because you have to see it." He deferred to Clara in a number of ways, sometimes subtle, sometimes not, and forced soft arguments he knew he could not win, and played certain subjects toward her strength, which should have annoyed her but didn't, and was otherwise thoughtful, carrying her brand of cigarettes, and talking her through this dormant period in her work, a time of small despair. He had his cold. It was always there, voice a little woofy, his eyes dimmed by medications. And after AC's show, they all went to a disco somewhere, and she watched Miles and AC dance. And they looked completely great together, and how curious, of course, because there was no love lost. Or maybe not so curious. The lights were flashing, and the music shook the walls. It was the rooftop summer, still. And she sat in the dense shade of a grape arbor on a Chelsea roof, redwood posts and rafters and a latticework of cedar that was weathered bony gray. A poet walked across the roof. He came from the far end of the roof over the thin slate surface. He said, "They're writing the name Marie." And Clara looked out through the opening at the front of the arbor, fringed with broad puckered leaves, grape leaves of whatever variety of native grape, and she saw the smoke from a skywriting plane, spelling the name Marie. And the World Trade Center rising at the southern rim, the towers Siamese, when you see them from this angle, joined at the waist by a transit crane. What an encouragement it was that someone built this thing. Lugging so much wood and soil up 5 narrow flights, raising the posts and joists, and vines growing out of half barrels, old whiskey barrels, great girthed and stained. And she sat with 3 others at the table eating nachos and drinking sangria. The others did. Clara liked her wine unmixed. It was the summer of blue-black nights, ambiguous thunder to the east, hoarse and false, and the city grid below. A guy beheads his lover, puts the object in a box, and takes it on the train to Queens. And don't forget the poet drunk on a cast-iron bench, and the small, strange woman who photographed him obsessively. Clara watched the Skyrider's smoke begin to attenuate and drift. A cat walked along the ledge at the far end, astray from the alleys and back gardens. And she didn't know why, you never know why, but her mother was part of this moment, angry about something. And a neighbor with a special shoe, a man with a high shoe, an orthopedic shoe. Things, shapes, masses, memories, all the braid work of unmatching states. Even the poisoned air floats a woman's name. Miles took her to the studio of a video artist he knew. Not a studio, okay, but an ordinary set of rooms packed with equipment and TV sets where the guy lived and worked. People started arriving. There were people already there, and others started arriving. And there was a pungent trail in the air. The root aroma of marijuana rolled and toked communally. And a sense of some event, not unlike the showing of a midnight film. Only not so loose a group, a little beady-eyed, these people, wary of their own anticipation. They sat on the floor, mainly. There were a few folding chairs and a sofa in one room, and a number of people stood huddled in corners, but most of them sat on the floor, which was covered with soda stains and unspeakable scuzz. TV sets were arranged in stacks everywhere in the flat, and other sets were parked individually on TV tables with copies of TV Guide. And there were sets with rabbit ears and a few old mahogany consoles, and every size screen from the smallest imported eyeball to the great proscenium face of the household god. And one whole wall in one room, there was a TV wall. Maybe 100 identical sets, banked floor to ceiling. Clara and Miles stood in a corner, and she'd begun detaching herself from the event long before she got here, because she'd been told what it was at some point, but still had to see it, whatever the level of misgiving. The event was rare and strange. It was the screening of a bootleg copy of an 8mm home movie that ran about 20 seconds. A little over 20 seconds, probably. The footage was known as the Zapruder film, and almost no one outside the government had seen it. Of course, the event had a cachet, an edge of special intensity. But if those in attendance felt they were lucky to be here, they also knew a kind of floating fear. A mercury reading out of the 60s, with a distinctly trippy edge. The footage started rolling in one room, but not the others. And it was filled with slurs and jostles. It was totally jostled footage. A home movie, shot with a Super 8. And the limousine came down the street, muddied by sun glint, and the head dipped out of the frame and reappeared, and then the force of the shot that killed him unexpectedly, the headshot. And people in the room went, ooh, and then the next, oh, and 5 seconds later the room at the back went, ooh, the same release of breath every time, like blurts of disbelief. And a woman seated on the floor spun away and covered her face because it was completely new, you see, suppressed all these years. This was the famous headshot, and they had to contend with the impact. Aside from the fact that this was the president being shot, past the outer limits of this fact, they had to contend with the impact that any high-velocity bullet of a certain lethal engineering will make on any human head. And the shearing of tissue and brain case was a terrible revelation. And, oh shit, oh God, it came from the front, didn't it? And that was the other thing. All these things in the sequence that begins with the frame 313. And wouldn't you know, Miles would say later, there had to be a 13 somewhere in the case. She was getting backaches again, and sleeping episodically, and it hurt to sit in a chair sometimes. They told her to go to a yoga class. They told her about herbal teas and holistic massages. She went to the hospital to see Jack Marshall, who was recovering from heart surgery, and she went with Esther, who thought that a hospital visit was a thing out of pharaonic antiquity, where you fixed your face and arrayed yourself sedately, and you carried books, puzzles, and flowers, and brought along a priest to utter certain phrases. Esther didn't seem to know what went on in hospitals, and she moved at a cringing gait, leaning away from doors to patients' rooms, afraid she'd glimpse something or catch something, taking it all personally, a challenge to her remoteness from such matters. Jack said that catheter was the ugliest word in the language. They told her to eat whole grains, take warm baths, to see a man in Finland who did the lower back. She went to AC's opening, of course, in a hot new gallery uptown in the early fall. And AC looked sensational, in a white linen suit with a sequin bandeau, and the work was all breasts and heart-shaped asses, a raunchy assault in which a woman's body parts, her skin-tight gowns and full mouth and bazoomy tits, become a kind of politics. There was no comfort here, Clara thought. If women have a condition called incompleteness, and some recover nicely and some don't, then these paintings were flaunting it, loving it, shoving it in your face. And AC located her arguments in composition and perspective, in the odd bodiness, the massive off-center ass, the misalignments, the relationship of breasts to body, the way Jane came angling out of her Jaguar, all avid excess, her knees and dimpled crotch bursting out of their package. It was a question of lines of force. Here was a woman who lived outside the bureaucratic needs of male desire, outside the detailed ceremonies and horny hands. AC used off-tones, flesh tones, completely non-pop, a lot of sand and amber, and a beautiful burnt rose, a sunburnt strip that ran across the top of every canvas, a little sad and frayed, and all of it slightly blurry and doubled. Color Xeroxed, that was the telling touch. You have copycat Jane, the reproduced goddess, and she is all the more strong for being unoriginal. They went to a disco somewhere, and she watched Miles and AC dance, and they looked totally great together. And she felt a little jealous, of course. And she still felt jealous half a minute later, not jealous but begrudging, when AC danced with a woman. She watched them weave and shimmer in the flashing lights, and she was admiring and begrudging both, taken by the sight of them, the other woman in jeans and braided sandals, some diplomat's daughter, Clara thought, hair hung down in spiral curls, and how completely easy they were in their physical mien, a grace of a certain passing abandon, searching each other's eyes in the fever strobes, and she was stung by her reaction. AC's ascent, AC's name in the air, her brash talent and sense of freedom, and her self-asserting manner, and how she wants it all and'll probably get it, and dancing sort of striped in the lights, with her jacket flying open, and the music shaking the walls. The funny thing is, Esther wasn't kidding. A priest showed up, from some actor's chapel, arranged by Esther. Although Jack hadn't been to church in 40 years, except for midnight mass at Christmas, which he attended, as they say, religiously. They sat around and talked about Broadway show tunes. Jack was too weak to sing or tell jokes. He was a great splayed length of pounded veal. Esther held his hand until she had to go out for a smoke. She'd stopped and started again, and the priest went with her, and Clara adjusted the pillow for Jack. And when she embraced AC at the end of the evening, It was the end of Clara's evening because the music in that place was a form of brain seizure, and she had to get out fast. And when she embraced AC and told her the show was great and wished every blessing on her head, it was an experience of shadings and half-meanings and an awful sort of feeling. To extend love to a friend with reluctance. She decided to go to Los Angeles with Miles. He'd run out of money for Normal, Illinois, and was trying to get financing from an Israeli gangster who lived in L.A. Or there were two men, maybe. She wasn't sure. One Israeli and one gangster. And she decided she'd go. She didn't like the idea of going, but she thought she'd go out of a sense of loose ends, or whatever the exact state of mind. She wasn't sure of that, either. And the poet drunk on a cast-iron bench, the visiting Romanian on the roof, and how a woman no one knew shot 7 rolls of film and left without a word.
This ends Disc 16.